Beloved congregation in our Lord Jesus Christ, Lord's Day 5 actually makes really two very basic points about the judgment of God. First, in question and answer 12, the Catechism makes the point that it is impossible for us to be righteous before God except by the satisfaction of his justice. We have sinned. That justice of God must be satisfied if we are to be again received into favor. And the second point that the Catechism makes is that it is impossible for us to make that satisfaction. And it gives then two reasons for that. The first of the reasons why we cannot make that satisfaction is that we are daily increasing our debt. We are not in the process now of paying off that debt. We are rather still increasing the debt. And the second reason is that we are not able as creatures to bear the wrath of God and live, or bear the wrath of God in such a way as to redeem ourselves from that wrath. The wrath of God will destroy us. In fact, the Catechism says then in question and answer 14, no creature is able to do that. And therefore, we need a mighty mediator, one who is more powerful than all creatures. Now, if we turn to Job chapter 9, that's where we're going to focus our attention tonight. If we turn to Job chapter 9, we see that Job really makes this same point in a different context and for a different purpose. But still he's saying throughout this chapter, chapter 9, that we need a mighty mediator, one who is mightier than ourselves. So let's consider the Lord's Day under the theme, our need for a mighty mediator. First, then considering what Job has to say in chapter 9, how can a man be righteous before God? That's really verses 1 to 13. Secondly, how can I answer him? That's in verses 14 to 21. Thirdly, he destroys the blameless and the wicked, verses 22 to 26. And finally, you will not hold me innocent, verses 27 to 35. Let's go back a moment to the chapter 8, because, of course, Job in chapter 9 is responding to what Bildad says in chapter 8. What Bildad says in chapter 8 is really basically just one thing, and that is that God is righteous in his judgments. He says it at the beginning of chapter 8, verse 3, does God subvert judgment? Or does the Almighty pervert justice? And he says it again at the end of the chapter, verse 20. Behold, God will not cast away the blameless, nor will he uphold the evildoers. Job is responding then in this chapter to that speech of Bildad, to that assertion of Bildad that God is righteous in his judgments. And the very first thing that Job says in response to that speech is, verse 2, truly, I know it is so. He acknowledges the truth of what Bildad has been saying in chapter 8. God, he says, is indeed righteous in his judgments. He's not trying to deny that righteousness of God. But he says to Bildad then, that doesn't solve my problem. Yes, God is righteous in his judgments, but you're not getting to the root of my problem. The root of my problem, Job says, the second part of verse 2, but how can a man be righteous before God? Yes, God is righteous in his judgments. Yes, God does not cast away the blameless. Yes, he will not uphold evildoers. But the question is, how can a man be righteous before God? You'll say that he will justify the righteous, but how does a man establish that righteousness? How does he make it plain in the judgment of God that he is righteous? How can he be one of those blameless ones? And let's recognize immediately that Job is not talking here in a general way. That is, he's not saying, how can a man be righteous in his whole life? And how can he expect a sentence of innocence from God upon his whole life? What Job is rather trying to do here is point out that man has to deal with this problem in specific, particular historical circumstances. That is, there are times when he is accused. There are times when perhaps he has sinned, but other times when perhaps he has not sinned, and yet he has to come into the presence of God and be judged by God, and he has to defend his righteousness before God. God, he's on trial, and he must defend his righteousness before him in these circumstances, and whatever those circumstances may be. And he says, in these individual situations, then, where a man has to justify himself before God, a man must be righteous before God, how can he do it? How can a man be righteous before God? And that's a rhetorical question. Job means to say, fundamentally, there is no way he can do it. It's impossible for him to justify himself before God. And when he says that, he is not, I think, saying, and we should see that also, he's not saying that's because man is a sinner. He's not saying, I can't justify myself. No man can justify himself before God because all men are sinners. What he's saying is that it's impossible no matter what. This is a fundamental impossibility with God. A man simply can't do it. No matter what his state, no matter whether he's righteous or guilty, makes no difference. He can't do it. How can a man be righteous before God? And he goes on then to say, if one wished to contend with him, this is a legal setting still, of course, that word contend has legal connotations. If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of 1,000. And a good example to illustrate that, of course, comes from the end of the book when God spoke to Job out of the whirlwind and asked him what Job probably felt like was 1,000 questions. And how many times did Job have an answer for God when God was asking those questions? Not once. Not once. If a man were to contend with God, he could not answer him even one time, Job says, out of 1,000. So that's the basic point that Job's making here in the first place. It's impossible for a man to justify himself before God. Now, why is that? Is it because man is a sinner and God is righteous? That's not what Job says here. In fact, throughout this chapter, Job makes very little reference to the righteousness or justice of God. Rather, what Job does here in the verses that follow, these first two verses of his answer, is say, man cannot make an answer to God, man cannot establish his righteousness before God because he's wise and strong. God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and prospered A man tries to harden his strength against God, and he doesn't prosper. God's strength is too much for him. And then Job goes on to show what he means by that strength of God. He illustrates that strength and wisdom of God from the works of God in his creation, just as God later does with him when he answers him out of the whirlwind. It's interesting how these themes keep on reoccurring in the book of Job, but with different purposes and from the mouths of different people. Now it's Job who's saying the same sorts of things here that God says to him later in the book. He removes the mountains and they do not know when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place. He's talking about earthquakes there. And its pillars tremble. He commands the sun and it does not rise. Maybe he's talking about eclipses. Maybe he's just talking about the power that God has to prevent the sun from rising if he wants to. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He made the bear Orion and the Pleiades and the chambers of the south. He does great things past finding out. Yes, wonders without number. God is great, Job is saying. And how can I as a man establish my righteousness before one who is so great? He then goes on in verses 11 to 13 to talk a little bit more about this greatness and wisdom of God as he observes it. If he goes by me, I do not see him. He's talking about the works of providence. God's always active in his creation. God's always, as it were, going by us in the works of his hands, making his power and his wisdom visible to us in those works. But Job says, I can't see him. I can see what he's doing, but I can't see him. I can't perceive him if he moves by me. He's utterly invisible to me. And because he's utterly invisible to me, I can't stop him, as it were, as he's passing by and say, hold on a minute. Let me have a talk with you here. If he decides to take something away from a man, who can hinder him? He does what he pleases, and man can't stop it. Who can say to him, what are you doing? No one can challenge his right, his authority to do that. He's beyond our reach. God will not withdraw his anger. The allies of the proud lie prostrate beneath him. Even the strongest men and their allies are crushed by his anger. So what's Job then saying in these first 13 verses? If a man wants to establish his righteousness with God, if he wants to plead his case before God, he finds that, we would put it this way, the playing field isn't level. They're not equal contestants in this case. And it's not, Job is saying, it's not a question of righteousness versus unrighteousness, or righteousness even versus righteousness, but it's simply a case of strength versus weakness. It's this case of wisdom versus folly. He's saying it doesn't really have anything to do with righteousness. How can a man make his righteousness evident before God when he's just utterly overwhelmed and crushed and overpowered by the strength and wisdom of God? This is too unequal a match for man to establish anything before God. We're too weak to defend ourselves. So the point here is a little different from the point that the Catechism makes. The Catechism also refers to the fact that mere creatures cannot sustain the burden of God's eternal wrath, but the Catechism is saying we can't sustain that burden to the end and pay our debt by sustaining that burden to the end. Job is saying here, we don't even have the strength to enter into judgment and defend ourselves. God is just simply too mighty, and we too insignificant and too weak. In verses 14 to 21, then, Job basically takes this principle, this idea that he stated in verse to how can a man be righteous before God, and he applies it to himself. How then can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? So he says, okay, this is true. God is righteous in judgment. But I'm asking you now, how can a man be righteous before God? God is too strong, and he makes even the proud lie prostrate beneath his feet. Well, how then can I bring any kind of answer to him? How can I choose my words to reason with him? And of course, Job is talking here now about his own circumstances, about the great calamities that God has inflicted upon him, about his friends' accusations against him, that surely God would not have done this to him unless he had sinned in some way, and about his own conviction that he's innocent of the charges his friends are making. His friends are very vague, but Job says, I haven't done anything to deserve this judgment of God. And he wants to justify himself before God. He wants to bring this whole matter into the court of God's justice. And he wants to plead his case before God. And he says, I can't do it. How can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? Notice how in verses 14, 15, and 16, Job is concerned with answering. The word occurs in each one of those verses. How then can I answer him? For though I were righteous, I could not answer him. If I called and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. This is a question of answers. God coming to Job and accusing him or questioning him, and Job saying, how can I answer him? And then going on to say, if I called and he answered me, and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. He wants then to respond to the accusations that have been made against him by his friends. But I think too that what he wants to do here is respond to the accusations that he himself thinks are implied in what God is doing to him. I think Job himself, at least at this point, has accepted the premise upon which his friends are acting. That is, that God does not do the kinds of things that he was doing to Job unless a man has sinned. But Job says, I haven't. This is my problem, he says. God's not supposed to do these things to the blameless and to the righteous, and yet he's done them to me. And I want to plead my case with him, and I don't know how to answer him. I come into his presence. I perhaps have prepared all my arguments, planned every word, made all my thoughts carefully organized in my own head. And then I come before him, and he's so great that I can't utter it. I have to shut my mouth. I don't know how to choose my words. I end up just stammering and sputtering before him as if I have nothing to say. For though I were righteous, he says, notice that, for though I were righteous, I could not answer him. Even, he says, if I were convinced, absolutely convinced that I were completely righteous, that I had committed no sin, I still wouldn't be able to say anything to him. I would end up begging mercy from my judge. That is, I would end up acting as if I were guilty, even though I was not. And he goes one step further and he says, if I called, and here, of course, this is just the very first step that he's taking towards coming into the presence of God. If I called to him and asked him if he would hear me, And he answered me, I wouldn't believe that he was listening to my voice. There's such a gap between us that I can't even believe that he's listening to me. It's partly because of his strength and his wisdom as described in verses 4 and following. But it's also, to go on then to the next verses, that he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not allow me to catch my breath, but fills me with bitterness. He says, look at what God has done to me. He's pounded me into the dust. He's utterly crushed me. He's so afflicted me that I can't even draw my breath. If I were to be able to stand in his presence, I wouldn't have enough breath even to speak. I'm filled with bitterness because of the severity of his hand upon me. How then can I answer him? How can I bring my case to him? How can I plead my righteousness if he's simply crushing me in this way? And so, if it's a matter of strength, he says, well, on whose side does the strength lie? Not on my side. He's the one who is strong. And if we can actually, he says then in the second part of that verse 19, if we can actually conceive of this happening on the basis of justice, of justice being the primary concern in this case, well, who's going to appoint me my day in court? How am I even going to get on his calendar to plead my case? He's so far beyond my reach that I can't even get a day in his court. I can't do it, and no one else can do it for me. It's worse than that. Verse 20. Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. So now he says, let's imagine that I actually have an opportunity to plead my case before God. What would happen? If I were absolutely righteous, I would still stumble and stammer and stutter so much, and my words in comparison to the words of God would be so feeble and weak and confused and hopeless that my own mouth would condemn me. If I were blameless, still my mouth would prove me perverse. This is how great the gap is. I can't do it. God is just too much for me to handle. Even if I were absolutely blameless, still my own words would make it appear that I was just making excuses or just stammering and stuttering around and trying to avoid the issue. I wouldn't be able at all to establish my righteousness before him. And he even goes one step further in verse 21. In verse 20, his righteousness is hypothetical. In verse 21, he claims it as a fact. I am blameless. I am blameless. Yet I do not know myself. In other words, he is blameless, but when he stands in the presence of this majestic, glorious, mighty God, he doesn't know it of himself. So great is the glory and strength of this God, that in the presence of that majesty, he cannot, even if he is, he cannot feel himself to be blameless. He ends up despising his life. I am blameless, yet I don't know myself. I despise my life. So again, he's saying, I don't know what to do. I'm blameless, but I don't know how to establish my righteousness with God. He's too much for me to handle. Even that is not the end of Job's complaint. Verses 22 to 26 carry it further. And Job says in verses 22 to 26, mainly this, he destroys the blameless with the wicked. It's all one thing. That is, God's judgment works for the same way for everyone. He destroys the blameless with the wicked. Now notice, let's just jump back a minute to verse 20, how concerned in verses 20, 21, and 22, Job is concerned with blamelessness. In verse 20, he speaks of hypothetical blamelessness. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. In verse 21, he says, I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. In verse 22, he basically says this, it doesn't matter whether I'm blameless or not, because he destroys the blameless with the wicked. And I think what we have to see here, people of God, is that what Job is saying is, in a limited sense, true. It's what Job's own experience has been, right? He has been innocent, and God is destroying him, busy destroying him. His complaint here is essentially the same complaint that Asaph makes in Psalm 73. The righteous are afflicted along with the wicked. Sometimes even worse than that, the righteous are afflicted and the wicked prosper. And that's not, I think we may say this, that's not a false accusation that he makes against God. There's a certain truth in that statement. God does deal harshly with the blameless, with the righteous. He makes them suffer, as he made Job suffer. So Job, I think, has not yet really overstepped the bounds. It's not until he gets to verse 23, I think, that he there suddenly oversteps the bounds. If the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent. Now that's not true. You might want to argue, well, what Job means is that God seems to be indifferent towards the plight of the innocent. He often seems to be asleep, or he often seems not to care. And the Psalms talk often about that, and maybe Job's just saying the same thing, but that's pretty strong language, isn't it? He laughs at the plight of the innocent. God takes delight in it. What kind of evidence does Job have for that? He can say God afflicts the innocent. God makes them suffer. But does he laugh at them? I don't think Job should have said that at all. But he says it, people of God, because of what is seen in verse 24. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. Who rules in the earth? Who has the power in the earth? The wicked do. He covers the faces of the judges. That is, he blinds their eyes so that they cannot see what's going on in front of their noses, and therefore can't make righteous judgments. If it's not God who does this, then who does? Is not God the sovereign one? It's God who ultimately controls everything that's going on in the earth. It's God who brings about this inequity in circumstances. It's God who afflicts and destroys the blameless. And here's what he's doing to me, verses 25 and 26. Now my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away, they see no good. They pass by like swift ships, like an eagle swooping on its prey. My days are short. And they are short because of the heavy hand of God upon me. In verses 27 to 35, then, he makes the basic point that God will not hold him innocent. Verse 28, I know that you will not hold me innocent. But he tries here in these verses to look for another solution to his problem. I can't bring my case into the presence of God. I can't argue my case before him. There's too great an inequality between us. His strength is too much for me. So why don't I just say this? I'll forget my complaint. I'll just push it aside. I'll put off my sad face and I'll wear a smile. I'll bear this all stoically and we'll deal with it that way. And he says, even that's hopeless. I can't even do that. I'm afraid of all my sufferings. I'm suffering under the hand of God. And I know that he won't hold me innocent. How can I be complacent? How can I wear a smile if I know that he is not going to hold me innocent? Job is, again, of course, transgressing beyond the bounds of human wisdom and human knowledge, of course, as God makes very plain to him at the end of the book. But this is how he's feeling right now. He says, these sufferings mean that God is not holding me innocent, and I know that he's not going to. And I can't simply wear a smile when I know that it is the heavy and angry hand of God that is against me. I can't simply dismiss my sufferings as relatively meaningless. If I am condemned, notice that, if I am condemned, why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow water and cleanse my hands with soap, yet you will plunge me into the pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. It doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter how clean I make myself. He's still going to plunge me into the pit. My labor will all be in vain. I will still stand condemned before him. I will be so abhorrent, so filthy, so objectionable that even my own clothes will abhor me. That's if I'm innocent. So he proposes another solution. Nor is there any mediator between us. Let's consider the possibility that if I can't do it, someone else might be able to do it for me, says Job. Well, that's not possible either. There's no mediator who can compel the parties to some kind of reconciliation or to some kind of settlement of their differences. God is not a man as I am, verse 32, that I may answer him and that we should go to court together. Again, that emphasis on the inequality between them. I can't bring him into court. I can't answer him. Simply because he's not a man. Not because I'm sinful and he's righteous. Simply because he's not a man and I am. Job sees in the end of this chapter only one solution to his problem. Let him take his rod away from me. Let him lift off from me that hand of strength that is oppressing me so much now and which makes me terrified of him. Do not let dread of him terrify me. Then, he says, then I could speak. then I would not need to be afraid of him. But it is not so with me. Of course, he hopes for an impossibility. God take his rod away. Man be free of the dread and terror of God. That would be to deny the differences between God and men. He seeks an impossibility. He doesn't want to be afraid, but he has to be afraid. If he were not afraid, God would not be God. But notice, people of God, that this is then a very, very despairing speech. We find no evidences of any hope here. We find no confidence in the righteousness of God. He may not actually dispute that righteousness, but he certainly does not found himself upon that righteousness. The only thing he's referring to here, things he's referring to here about God, is basically his power and his wisdom. And how does God exercise them? To crush him. Job thinks that there is no mediator who can lay his hand on us both. But he has forgotten something, hasn't he? That there is a mediator who can lay his hand on both. There is a mediator who's a man, and who can be, as a man, righteous before God. There is a mediator who is not dusty and frail and weak like other men, who can stand in the presence of God because he is God. There is a mighty mediator, one who is able to come into the presence of God on not just on his own behalf, but on our behalf, and do what is absolutely impossible for us. It is right and good, people of God, that we despair of our own strength. It is right and good that fundamentally we come to the same conclusion that Job comes to here. How can a man be righteous before God if he has to plead his own case? Even if he is righteous, his mouth will condemn him. He will be judged perverse. We need a mediator mightier than ourselves. And we need a mediator mightier than ourselves because God is too great for us. But the point that's missing from Job's thought and from Job's heart is that God has provided such a mediator. We have him. He is ours. May God bless the proclamation of his word.